soon, my young apprentice, our plan to hijack all of Canada's wonderful natural resources will be complete. Soon our claws will be deeply ingrained everywhere in Canada, and we will siphon every last drop of sovereign wealth into my joint bank account with Bill Gates.
Yes, Master. Your master plan is almost complete. Soon we will have control of the oil, of the gold, of the coal, of the iron, zinc, silver, copper, lithium, and of course all of their housing.
Oh, rates will be low for a very, very long time. Don't worry. Borrow as much as you can. Borrow, borrow, borrow. Take off that ridiculous mask, you idiots.
Sorry, Your Excellence. Sorry about that.
Operation Natural Forest Fires also seems to be a resounding success. We will get the land we want no matter what. Whether we steal it with the help of our buddy Doug Ford, or we burn it with a top-secret direct energy weapon, it will be mine. Oh yes, it will be mine.
You're a genius, my lord. You're a genius, my lord.
Sometimes I really just can't believe how easy this is. Canadian people are so stoned on legal cannabis and drunk on supercharged Canadian beer that they will fall for and put up with anything.
I can't believe that I'm still the Prime Minister.
We need to bring in as many slaves, immigrants, as we can. We need cheap slaves, skilled labor, to mine the resources and build the camps, 15-minute cities, neighborhoods.
I am working on that, my lord. It turns out that we let double the immigrants in than we thought we did, my lord.
But where will they all live?
Who cares?
They must own nothing, and they must be happy.
They will all own nothing, and they will be happy, my lord.
Excellent. Now it must be time for the Canadian Real Estate Show.
So,
what's up?
There's a lot frigging going on. This has been a
whole another direction
week.
We're heading in now. Let's just quick market update.
Sure. What's going on in the market?
It's a ghost town out there.
Ghost town.
I am getting calls now from so many agents. So first, the agents are calling me and they're, this is me talking them to the 2 months ago or whatever. Hey, my clients really like your property. We saw it on Wednesday. Do you, have any indication on, what the seller's motivations are, or, are they looking to, get it sold quickly? Like, where you guys are listed right now, it's just not in my client's budget, or we don't feel the value's there, but we would be maybe somewhere around this number. What do you think? Da, 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 da. And the agents are like, oh, we got people interested. We got second showings. We got offers. We got whatever, whatever. And I'm like, okay. So we go buy something else. And now I'm getting calls, 3 in the last 2 weeks. Well, hey, it's me calling from 123 Main Street. Are your clients still interested in that property? Because my clients are willing to come down in price now. And that happened 3 times.
Sure. I had another fucker on my street sell for way less. You saw the listing. Even you were like, what kind of strategy is this? It's like,
they listed low and they were 48 hours irrevocable, which is their way of saying, we're not going to do an offer date, but 24 hours irrevocable, but we don't want to just accept any offer. And then after short of a period, they were like, let's raise the price to, more than what we were asking before.
Makes no sense.
And then they ended up taking a price basically what they were asking in the first place. It was like, why did you move the price so much? So some agents are just out there.
I don't understand why it was at the price it was at. And it's the same agent that sold the house across the street for the same damn price. And it's definitely too low. It doesn't make any
she's
sense.
She's just stacking for her retirement.
Pissing me off.
That's all she's doing. It's okay, really so that story off. I gave you was just the one side of it, right? Now,
yeah. What's the other side?
Real estate stuff here. We're getting a lot of calls from agents, not just like several agents calling us and saying,
do you have something for me to do? Can I show a house for you?
No, I'm trying to sell my own home and I can't.
Ooh. Ooh. Yeah.
And
off
so they're
market.
Calling the
off
top
market?
Level teams. Nope, on the market. They're calling the top level teams. I imagine other teams are getting these calls too, but we're getting calls now saying, I've tried everything. I don't know what else I can do. I need your guys' help.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. The markets.
How often
it
is
so
that happening?
Quiet. I don't know what happened in September and why people were like,
you're,
you know,
ruining my buzz, think, man. You're ruining my vibe.
I'm just letting
here.
You know there's nobody buying out there right now. And I'm telling you that. I'm telling you there's nobody buying out there right now. I'm watching this unfold and the market is so much worse right now than it was over the last, like, I don't know, long
week?
Time.
Week?
No, like honestly, years.
Years.
It the just, amount like, of listings that are coming on compared to the number of sales, I have not seen this in a long time. At least that we had sales. At least when the market was correcting in 2022, 2023, we had
tsunami.
Some sales. It was just like the prices had to be a lot lower.
Tsunami.
There's nobody buying.
Tsunami of
I'm just
listings?
Saying, I don't know. There's nobody buying.
Is it a flood?
There's nobody buying right now. So
well,
what do you do when nobody's buying? How do you sell when you need to sell? You're getting a divorce. You bought already.
You need
the money for something important.
You hire the fucker that listed on my street twice. She'll sell it for under market really quickly.
You sell it for a lot lower than you were hoping for.
Oh my God.
Dum, dum, dum.
So are we seeing prices come down considerably here?
We're seeing like, we had a few really great sales this month where it was like, oh my God, that price was higher than what it was before.
Santa
because of
said
the right
prices
area
were going
strategy,
up.
All that kind of stuff.
Santa.
But then we're seeing other places priced up. Prices that should be flying off the shelves and they're not.
Santa's prices are going up the last week. That guy's on it every week.
I'm just letting you know what we're seeing on our own team side. So we are seeing some prices
that
are selling for higher than ever in certain situations.
Really?
It's like that house was in demand. We got multiples. It sold for more than asking. It sold for more than expectations. It sold, the seller got what they want. I'm seeing that. But then there's just like much less inventory. So there's a bunch of people who are sitting on the market who are not selling. And like you're like, this is a great price. Why is it not selling?
Yeah. And there's a lot in certain pockets, like piling up like crazy. It's pretty insane.
In certain pockets. There's other pockets that we're listing and there's no other competition. And you're going, okay, well, there's no one else competing with you. So you can kind of, you know, price it here to take advantage of that. But other places you're like, whoa, we need to be lower than the last guy because somebody else will be coming on while you're listed and they're going to do the same thing. And we got to get ahead of the market. And every situation is different.
Well, and meanwhile, you got that new condo in Pickering that's sold out in like 2 seconds for $10.50 a square foot. And people just rushed into literally 95% sold in 3 days or 5 days or something. Mm-hmm. I think I just saw something where they launched phase two already, because they were probably like, holy shit, we better sell another tower.
Bring out the
these...
other phase.
Yeah. Quick, before these idiots disappear. Yeah. Like, what the fuck?
We don't have a drawing yet. Just pick one up.
Call it phase two and go.
Phase 1.5.
Who cares
that, those must be the conversations that happen in some of these developer boardrooms, eh?
I don't know.
Like,
most of
even,
them were
we
like...
weren't even going to do another phase, but like these guys said they want to come in for phase two.
Better hurry. No, but you got weird things going on. Like Jordan. Yeah. Remember Jordan's site? $820 a foot out in Milton. Mm-hmm. Now you got $1050 a foot in Pickering. I mean, I guess, I don't know, is Pickering better?
I don't do pre-cons. I don't have enough data to tell you why.
It used to be that everything was just $1,100 a foot. If it wasn't in downtown, everything was $1,100 a foot. Now,
pre-con is directly related to how hard the agents are pushing it.
Well,
and
this
so
is the thing. This
it's
is the
like
thing.
The amount of messages. You know what I'm getting now too? This is so funny.
What?
Everything's changing. So now I'm getting messages from agents
funny,
to my cell number. Yeah. So they're looking up my number on my listings or whatever, and they're putting it in a database and they're texting me and they're like, hey, I got allocations at da 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 da. And I was just like, okay, you know, like why?
Me too.
You know what I mean? Like, this doesn't sound like it's an opportunity that I'm going to be, regretful of not taking advantage of. But there's a whole bunch of other things that are going on. Good for that guy who's texting me and reaching out to me. Good for that guy. He's hustling.
Yeah, man, you got to try. Anyways, yeah. I feel bad. I mean, we have our guests waiting in the wings here for a little while. Very excited to have him join us. This is supposed to be an exciting day, but you killed my buzz there. I came into this all excited. I had all these announcements.
Santo got you excited with his numbers.
Santo got me a little excited. Up and down. Well, you know, we're still very excited, TK. We got the best deal in the world.
I'll get excited. Best deal in the world to talk about today.
We got Devin Cranston here, everybody. Check it out. Devin, my
new
best friend. TK,
new best friend, for sure. Hi, TK. Nice to meet you.
He's got you on a short leash, though, Devin. I'm going to warn you, okay? You know, I was his new best friend like a year ago, and then I got cut. So
it was like a month.
I'll be his new best friend for the month of October, and as soon as I cut him a check for $5 million, he'll find another new best friend.
That's right. Right. It'll be ignore.
Top liver.
Ignore.
Yeah.
But thanks. Devin, excited. Let's give Devin an introduction here, Del.
Well, I would like to tell everybody, Mr. Cranston here has decided to help us and work with us and partner with us on our deal in Forest Hill to help us raise a bunch of money. So he is one of the top in the game, as far as I'm concerned. He is he's been doing this a long time. How long have you been doing this for?
Let's let Devin introduce himself. Devin, tell us more about yourself.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Daryl. So I started Cranston Capital in 2006 as a corporate finance advisory firm. But in 2011, I was approached by Anthony Heller, who is the founder of PlazaCorp and one of the biggest developers, I would say, in the country, about creating an exempt market dealer to raise capital for specifically PlazaCorp developments in 2011. And so we started doing that and have, at the time we were doing some other tech deals and private equity and some other stuff. But over time we've shifted completely to real estate. We'd still look at some, you know, multifamily or seniors housing or some other assets, but 90% of what we do is finance residential development. And we have 22 active projects right now across the GTA with a variety of different developers. We've got some sites that we're just taking through the rezoning process and, you know, hope to sell to a developer when it's zoned. But majority of what we do is right through to completion. One Yorkville is probably the address that most people would recognize. We put $28 million into that when PlazaCorp bought the land back in 2013. And all of our investors did very well on the exit when it completed a couple of years ago. We also have, so high rise is obviously something we're very experienced in, but we also have low rise, mid rise, townhouses. So we're kind of across the board in terms of residential. We see a huge need for housing, and we want to, you know, put investors' money to work. There's going to be a huge capital requirement to, you know, keep up with what CMHC says we need to build in the province.
Hey guys, it's time to hit that bell, press that like button, drop a comment. We respond to every single comment. How many YouTubers? Most, maybe.
Most.
I answer every single comment. Most.
You answer less than me. Yeah.
And I'm telling you, no other YouTubers do that. So
that's
give us
worth
a like,
subscribing,
give us a comment, and definitely subscribe
and share. And don't forget, if you're interested in investing in the deal of a lifetime, and I'm not kidding here, TK, we all know it. This is exciting. We get to do this with Cranston Capital. And if you're interested in this deal at all, or you just even want to see the deck, click
or attend the webinar.
Attend the webinar, but click the link below. Get on the list because it's going to be very, very tough to get a seat at this table, but it will be well worth it. Right, TK?
I'm in.
TK's in. Right, Devin?
I'm in too.
You're in too. And I'm in, surprisingly. This is a trifecta. Please subscribe.
Across the board in terms of residential, we see a huge need for housing, and we want to, you know, put investors' money to work. There's going to be a huge capital requirement to, you know, keep up with what CMHC says we need to build in the province.
Mm-hmm.
Canadians love real estate, you know, like, you know, I want to invest in a tech company, or I want to invest. Sure. It exists.
As long
but
as it has to do with
wants
real estate.
To put their money in real estate. Yeah. As long as they're working on real estate, real right? prop tech. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we talk a lot to investment advisors and guys who sell investments all day long and try to explain to them that real estate, there's different areas and ways to invest in real estate. So you can buy a condo and rent it out. You can buy a commercial plaza. You can buy a cottage and Airbnb it. You can buy an office building. Those are all ways to invest where you're hands on and you have, you know, a lot of stuff to deal with. You can invest in a REIT where it's passive, but you're subject to public markets fluctuations. Development is completely different from all of that. Development is really just the manufacturing of housing. You know, we always talk about, we have this analogy to the shoemaker. And if someone came to you, if you're Nike and someone came to you and said, here's an order for 100,000 shoes. And Nike comes to me and says, will you finance this order? And I know that they're sold already. For sure, I'll finance it. I know that it's going to cost you $3 to make the shoe and you're going to sell it for $5. And there's a $2 profit there. You know, it makes sense for me to finance it because I know it's sold. And that's a lot of what, you know, the development industry is. You pre-sell before you build. So you're de-risking. And you can only do that if you have a profit margin. The bank won't lend you any money if there's no profit margin. And so if there is a profit margin and you're with a developer who knows what they're doing, and we're very conservative in our forecasting, you can almost not guarantee, but feel very comfortable that there's going to be some profit at the end. They're not going to build it if they won't be able to build it if there isn't. So it's very different from buying a real estate asset and hoping it appreciates or hoping that it cash flows or worrying about the cap rates. You don't have to worry about any of that. You have to worry about, can it sell for more than it costs to build? And that's really all you have to look at.
From the comfort of your own living room.
Yeah.
Not having to worry about it. Is that the biggest raise you've done, is One Yorkville?
That was 28 million. That was the biggest raise that we've done. We've done a lot of others, anywhere from 5 million up to 25.
Nice. And so this is like, this is the business model, just to people understand who are listening right now, right? It's like, you guys are, what would you call it? Are you guys like a securities firm? Like what do you guys call it?
Yeah, we're an exempt market dealer. So we're exempt registered with the Ontario Securities Commission, and we're registered in Alberta and BC and Quebec and Newfoundland as well. So we kind of keep things on side from a securities law perspective for the developer. Developer can say that they want to go raise money. And if they get it from three guys who are writing $5 million checks, that's fine. But as soon as someone wants to go raise money, $50,000, $100,000, $250,000 at a time, you really need a dealer in the middle to, you know, do the securities law requirements.
Because so everyone's always worried about risk, right? Like that's always like, you talk to anybody about investing in real estate, they get nervous right away. They say, oh, what's the risk? And, where's my money going? And who's holding my money? And how is it being monitored? And obviously the government knows this as well. So it's a requirement to have a company like yours in order to raise money in this way.
Yeah, the real requirement is suitability. Is we have to do a know your product. So we have to understand what we're putting people into, and we have to be able to explain the investment to the investors. But it's our responsibility to make sure that it's suitable. So a big part of suitability is, you know, is an 80-year-old going to go into a high-rise project that might take 6-7 years? It might not be suitable. Now, if that 80-year-old is investing for future generations and they don't need that money for themselves in their life, then it might be okay. But we have to always look at the suitability. And the reason why these types of investments are, you know, deemed high risk from the Securities Commission is because they have no liquidity. You put your money in, and that's the biggest risk, that you can't get it. You can't access it. You have to wait till the project finishes.
Hmm. So, and just so for contrast, or even just to kind of paint a picture, maybe you're going to answer in a way that I'm not expecting, but we started the show, Taiki was talking about how poor the real estate market is right now in the city and how it's kind of become a ghost town. But like, are people investing in your fund and investing in deals right now? Like what's the flavor for that kind of action? Because it's obviously a longer term, like you just said. How does it contrast in comparison to the real estate market, which TK says is a ghost town right now?
Yeah, and it's not, they're different markets. The real estate market, that I think TK is referring to is, you know, there's a lot of inventory, people trying to sell units, and there aren't that many buyers. And pre-con, there just isn't. There were a bunch of launches, but aren't that enough buyers out there that are willing to buy because they might not cash flow based on what they're looking at today. The beauty of investing in development is you're not looking at the market today. You're looking at the market in the future. So like Daryl, the deal that we're talking about in Forest Hill, you're not going to sell those units till 2025. That's a completely, you know, I'm not going to tell you what interest rates are going to be in 2025, but I don't think they'll be higher than they are today. And so I think people either have adjusted to the new interest rate reality or the rates may come down. What I do know is that we need more housing. So we need to build more. And you know, if we keep investing in the future, the market will come. You know, one of the things we always talk about supply and demand. I think real estate agents look at it as inventory on the market, but we look at it as starts and completions. And if nobody's starting anything in 2023, in 26 and 27, we won't have any new inventory to add to the market because there won't be any completions. And the population just keeps going. So we need to figure out how to build more. And people talk a lot about affordability and prices. And one of the things I think is really interesting is no one really talks about the cost, replacement cost. So today, the resale market is cheap because you can't replace. Like if you're selling a condo in downtown Toronto right now, a resale for $1,100 a foot, I don't think I could build that. I don't think I could get, think I could build a new one for $1,100 a foot. Right. So if we not do Toronto. Need more housing, the prices are going to go up because the cost is so high. And now maybe they'll get rid of DCs. I doubt they'll get rid of them, but maybe they'll lower them a little bit. Maybe, you know, we've already seen just very recently that some of the trades have started to, prices have started to come down because they're not as busy. So
process speed will help us also. Like if the city is being as helpful as they've been, you know, like we've seen recently, like that will cut down on some interest costs, which are quite significant. If you can save a year of interest right now, that helps to perform probably more than this GST stuff.
Yeah, you know, they always say in development that time kills the returns. In the past few years, it hasn't been the case because, like, I'll give you an example. We had a project at Yonge and Finch that we acquired in 2017, and we took through the zoning process. We had to go to the province, what was the OMB and OLT. We had to go twice because the councillor just wouldn't agree with us. Even city planners were on board, but the councillor wouldn't sign off. So we had a battle. It took us 5 years to get zoning there. But the land value, I think we invested $17 million of equity, but the land went up by $35 million in that 5 years. So just on the land lift, we did really well. And then when we went to launch sales, I mean, I think we targeted at that site that, you know, we would sell when we did this in 2017, it would be selling in the 800s or something. And when we finally sold in 2022, it was over 1,300.
Right. Okay. So, and that happened to a lot of people, but the costs went up considerably from the Proforma too, didn't they?
For sure. But in that project, we're making a big land lift and we were able to take our capital out, not all of it, but 80% of our capital out back to investors. And now there's still a 200% profit in the deal. It'll be 8 or 9 years by the time it's finished, but I don't think anyone's going to be upset. The IRRs will be great because we were able to return a lot of capital already. But I don't know if that's going to continue because if you look forward 9 years, I don't know if you'll have the same level of lift in value. So, you know, it was okay to say 5 years for zoning on that site because everything was going up and up and up the whole time. But if it takes 5 years now to do a rezoning, I don't know you'd have the same land lift. So
but also less likely that construction costs will go up. So yeah, you may not have that same appreciation that we've seen, but the likelihood of construction costs going up another 35% or something like that from already where they are now, and the likelihood of the timelines going any longer, if anything, construction costs remain the same or come down, and if or increase very marginally, or the time part actually decreases.
Yeah, so that's what
you're not expecting as much appreciation, I think.
Yeah, to Daryl's point, I think the timeline, we've seen the changing of the guard at City Hall and the fact that the city planners are now, as Daryl, I think, mentioned before, are a lot younger and more exposed to what's going on in the housing market than they used to be. It's just a different feeling. And I think we are going to see, and because the province put like a 120-day time limit on them, I think we're going to see things move through that process quicker. I don't know, like today, and if you look in a very short-term view, you see construction costs coming down because they're not that busy. I don't know if I would agree over a 4 or 5 year period, you'll see construction costs come down. I think actually the biggest hurdle, I think, in the industry is the fact that our labor pool is dying out.
That's what I was going to say.
Literally dying, but retiring out.
There's going to be a point where like costs are definitely coming down now because like we see like jobs, people, we lost 45 or 55,000 jobs in the construction sector. But when things ramp up again and there's nobody to do the work, the costs are going to go bananas, right? So
I'm going to take the opposite view. I just want you to know, but go ahead. Finish your point. Go.
I think I finished it.
I got real world evidence here. Okay. So I'm driving. I'm at Avenue Road. You know, when you get off and you go north and you cut through Armor and all those little streets there to get over to Bathurst.
Okay.
And so there's some construction going on there. And when I go through, there's 5 guys holding the slow stop signs.
Yeah.
And they're all Indian guys. Okay.
We need to bring in skilled labor.
We got people coming on board who are going to be doing the work that people who are born here don't want to do.
Okay. So I've been saying this for a while. I'm on the board of a seniors housing business in Alberta, and we own these seniors homes in rural towns. And we for years, we could not find healthcare workers to come into these homes, like in the middle of Cold Lake, Alberta. How are you going to get nurses there and other healthcare workers? The government has a program where you can sponsor someone from, and I don't know why they're all from the Philippines. I think it's other countries you can bring them in, but it seems like all of these healthcare workers, I guess because the Philippines trains nurses really well, and hospitality workers and other industries. We end up populating these seniors home with all these Filipino people who are coming over skilled in healthcare and nursing. And it's funny, you go to these small towns in Alberta and everybody is, you know, looks like UTK in terms of like skin color. And then there's a few Filipino ladies who work or families who have come to work in the healthcare industry. And that's it. That's
and their families and stuff too.
Yeah. And so I expect that in construction, we should be doing the same thing. We should be looking at places where they have trained people. Like they always talk about how, you know, the Greeks and Italians are so good at construction and maybe it's India now, but bringing in or look at China, like they built a ton in the last 10 years and now they can't build anymore. So why don't we go find the people who were doing that work in China and you know, fast track their visas if they're in the construction trades.
With automation and with offsite construction and things like that too, those things won't be as important. Are you a real estate agent and you're looking to make a change? Anywhere in Ontario, guess what? We're hiring. Franklin Associates, number one team in the GTA for all RE/MAX teams, number one team for all teams from all companies for number of units sold throughout Toronto. So if you're looking to make a change, best decision I ever made was to join Franklin Associates. Go to jointeamleo.com and we can set up a call. You know, like the guy who could do that perfect plaster ceiling, you know, that Italian craftsman from 1965 that died out. We're like, oh man, where are we going to find that guy? Now you can get an 18-year-old kid making $18 an hour and he can spray the popcorn ceiling on, right? Or you can bring in a guy who's got the machines. You should see the machines they use to make smooth ceilings now. They spray it on. I just had a client do it. They spray it on and then he comes and he does the machine with the trolley. Like there's so much automation. You know?
For sure, and modular, you know, prefab. There's all kinds of stuff that the industry
skills
is moving towards for sure. Yeah, that should help.
Exactly.
But I still believe that we need to do something about the labor pool and just get ahead of it. I mean, that's why we need immigration to continue, is because we have a labor issue and can see it coming. And I just think in construction, it's a more acute. You can really see the forming guys, like they're just. People aren't coming up and, you know, they're not graduating from university saying, hey, I want to go in construction. And they really should, because they can make a great living.
Well, Devin, you don't know this, but this week I was out on the streets talking to people, real people, people who are here now, you know, in Canada, working hard, doing the things that, you know, we all hope that they're going to do. And we're going to play a little clip here. You won't be able to see it, Devin, but it's going to give people a real insight into what our new Canadians are really thinking.
Wow.
Thanks, Daryl.
One of them. One new Canadian.
Well, the one new
Canadian. Yes, there is perfect insight there.
Right. So the, even though I'm talking like this, at the end of the day, a lot of people are coming here. Life's not easy here, Devin. Life's not easy. They come here. They don't want to stay. They're spending all their money on food, housing, sending it back home.
There's different levels of them, unfortunately. Like, there are plenty coming here having a gay old time with all kinds of dough, buying all kinds of shit and having a great time. And their goal isn't really to do all that. It's just to get money here, I think, right? Mm-hmm. We like them. But when you say immigration needs to continue, as much as I, from one perspective, agree, I think it could be tamed a little bit. I think we need to kind of rearrange what we got here already a little bit and see if the pieces fit, because it feels like the country's kind of ripping apart at the seams. Like, it doesn't seem like you can get much done properly anymore at any kind of pace. Like, I mean, medically and like with paperwork with the government, although planning is on board with things, that's not what matters. Like, get a passport or get your driver's license, or they abolished the stickers on licenses because it was like there was too much to do. They couldn't keep up with everything else. Like, give them the stickers back, right? But like, we can't keep bringing in a million plus people every year.
Yeah, I don't think that's the right number. I think it should be in the 400,000-500,000. And I do think that the international student fiasco is a bit of a problem. We are looking now at student housing because there's an opportunity in all kinds of towns across the country. But, you know, I just thought of an anecdote. Like, in December, I took my family to Jamaica, and we got an Uber on the way to the airport, and it was a Jamaican guy, and we were talking to him in the car, and he was in construction, and he was telling us how Toronto is so difficult, he can't make any money here. And I was shocked that he was saying it. And he was talking about moving to Nunavut because he said there's so much money there, and you know, it's such a huge opportunity for him. And I was surprised that that's what he was going to do. Then we get to Jamaica, and we go to the same place all the time. We know a lot of the staff there, and someone had their cousin at the resort. That one of the staff had their cousin that was there. I think he used to work at the resort, and he was there as a guest. And I sat at the bar with him and chatted with him a little bit. And he's telling everybody, you got to come to Canada. He makes so much money. He came to Toronto 10 years ago, and he's doing so well, and way more than he could ever make in Jamaica. And it was literally like 3 days apart where I have a Jamaican in Toronto telling me that he can't make it in Toronto. And then a Jamaican who lives in Toronto, but in Jamaica, telling everybody in Jamaica to come to Toronto. So there's different perspectives from different people. I think that there is still lots of opportunity in Canada if you're willing to work for it. And I do think that we need to continue to bring, like I said, skilled labor in, because we're going to have to replace all the workers who want to retire, all the baby boomers.
If those guys were a decade apart, their experiences, I think it's like two different countries, quite honestly, right? Like, it's Canada's not the same Canada as it was even 5 years ago, let alone 10 years ago.
More recently. One thing that people don't talk about is, like, the Canadians who are here all have this Canadian dream, which is buy real estate, own real estate. It's the only way to go. If you don't, you're like a shame to the family and everything else. Where people coming here, I think that won't be instilled in them, and that they're going to come here, they're going to look at the numbers, and they're going to say, oh, it makes more sense for me to rent. It makes more sense for me to live in one house with multiple people, different families, and keep my housing costs down and make that income and then do whatever I want from it. So I think the demand for buying places as far as end users, so condos and all that kind of stuff, won't be able to keep up. And I think that the purpose-built rental building strategy, which is clearly expanding, and now the government's got their, you know, the GST and then the HST, and then we've got all the CMHC's Canada Mortgage Bond Fund and everything like that. Everybody's increasing now to be able to get more money into purpose-built rental housing. And I think that that will satisfy the demand from immigration. So, Darryl, I hear what you're saying, but I think that the percentage of new Canadians renting is very high compared to people who are here.
It's interesting. I think your perspective is very Toronto. And not to disrespect anything, but, but Montreal has got a way higher propensity to rent than homeownership. And if we could all copy Montreal, I think would be fine. But you're right that the Toronto dream is you got to own the real estate.
Otherwise, you're a bum. You failed in life because you don't own a bungalow in Etobicoke or something. Yeah.
My grandfather, you know, lived in Montreal for 90 years of his life and rented. And it wasn't strange. Like, he had a business. He invested in his business. He invested in the stock market. He just didn't invest in real estate. It probably was a big mistake. He could have made a ton of money because, you know, if he bought a house in 1950 in Montreal, it would have done really well. But he rented, and it was normal to rent in Montreal. And I think that we need to try to normalize renting. Mm-hmm. If you guys follow my social media, you'll see that just posted a picture of me and a developer with a sledgehammer this week at our purpose-built rental site that we just demoed on Tuesday on Shepherd Avenue in Clanton Park.
And so you just got a nice little bonus with this GST, right?
Yeah, we kind of did the math. It's going to be, you know, $6-7 million savings on a 170 unit rental building. There's some potential
right on
savings,
Shepherd.
Right on Shepherd. There's some potential savings on the DCs as well that they've recently announced. But I could tell you the biggest holdback is we can only build purpose-built rental with CMHC financing, right, unless you're a pension fund that has a different return profile and you can wait 20 years to get your return. If you're a normal investor trying to do a purpose-built rental, the only way it works is with CMHC. Yeah. And I think it's amazing that they announced that they were going to increase whatever $20 billion more in the CMHC program. But what I want to hear is that they're going to double their staff, because that's our issue right now, is it takes forever. Like, it used to be it takes forever to get through zoning. We've been zoned on the site, we demoed the site. We can't get the CMHC to move fast enough. And that's going to be our biggest hold up right now on that project, is just waiting for, I mean, it's not going to hurt. We're not that far away. We're in the process with them. But if someone came to me today with another purpose-built rental and said, I'm going to do it, I'd say you need CMHC. And then I would probably add a year to their timeline, because right now I don't have faith that CMHC can move fast enough. And we talked before about how time kills development. So I hope with that announcement this week that they're going to look at that and boost their staff, because that's the biggest thing that they need. And then it's also municipalities. Like, we're dealing with, we have a project in Richmond Hill. We got our zoning a long time ago. We built, it's a low-rise project. We built, I don't know, a third of the houses. We sold another third of the houses a year ago, more than that, probably a year and a half ago, we sold the houses. Can't get a permit. Don't know how to. They just don't respond. The city of Richmond Hill has been one of the most difficult I've ever seen in terms of, they don't have staff. There's nobody in their office that can give us a permit.
It's like Scarborough. Have you been to Scarborough's city center there? It's like a ghost town. There's just weeds growing everywhere in the middle of the concrete. It's crazy.
We'll see. We have a project in Scarborough. We have actually three projects in Scarborough, and they've been good so far.
They've been good, but no one's in the office at all. It's like empty ghost town.
Speaking of projects, I we don't have forever, so I want to talk about Daryl's site, and I want to ask you some questions, Evan. It seems like you're, like, I thought you were just on the financing side, but it seems like you're also on the development side. You have a lot of knowledge on the development side, and you're actually pretty active, maybe in your own personal investments or whatever, on the development side.
So yeah, it's just how we kind of run our business. Like, I when I create a limited partnership that goes into the partners of the developer, I take control of the GP, and I have oversight and governance over the developer. So the developer has a development management agreement where they get to make the decisions, but they have to come to us for approvals for a whole bunch of things. And because we're in so many projects, we add a ton of value to the developer. Like, we have trades that are on site on five other projects right now. So when you're going to, you know, price out, we can see what's real and what's happening and what other people are getting. Sales, the same thing. So we add a lot of value just because we're so active.
Just their board of directors, like, just the board of directors alone, there's so much firepower and good knowledge. It's really unreal. Yeah.
But the reason I asked that is because it's not just like you guys were like, oh, you guys need some money. Sure, we'll help you raise it. It was like, you were like, hey, let's take a look at this project. Let's see if it's any good. Let's see if there's going to be any profits at the end, you know, for us to bring to our investors. And so, like, you've really gone through this already as much as you can at this point to figure out if this is something that people would be interested in.
Yeah, we ripped apart Daryl's pro forma, and we're very conservative.
And you made your own, and
pretty much. We know. I mean, like Daryl said, we have a very a good board that helps us out a lot. And one of the guys on our board is one of the biggest construction managers in the city. And when we took the pro forma to him and we said, we're going to build wood, he said, no, you build concrete there. It's going to be a nice, fancy building. You're not going to save enough money by building wood, build concrete. Yeah. And then he told us high end, what it's going to cost to build high end fancy on hards. And it was much higher than Daryl's number. And we put it in the pro forma and it still worked. So, So we're comfortable because we're conservative and, you know, we think that Daryl will beat the numbers that we put together. So, we lean on the experience we have, as a firm, and then the people that we have around us as well.
But you vet everything. So, and like you're saying, there's some control elements, you have a lot of experience. So as you're talking to the investors and stuff, you're able to give them like really confident answers and what their expectations should be at this point.
Yeah, we know the story. We've done enough in the space that we know what hurdles he's going to run into and what challenges he's going to have, and we can help him, you know, navigate through that and deal with things that come up. And you know, on this project, Daryl's never really built a six-story building before, so we're going to hold his hand and be there and make sure that everything goes right, because we have a reputation to hold up with our investors. We got to make sure that our investors make money. So
I'm sure those projects you said no to, where people are coming to you saying, hey, we need lots of money. And you look at it and you're going, yeah, you do, but it's not from us.
No, you could tell me, you could name projects in the city. There's a good chance we've seen them and turned, like, we look at hundreds of projects and we do five or six.
That's how we met. He said no to me.
Yeah. I said no on the first one that you brought. Right? Yeah.
Kingston or?
Tyndall.
Okay.
So yeah, we say no. I mean, we just saw one of our competitors raise a ton of money for a project downtown that we saw, and two other developers had this site before and they both brought it to us and we said no both times. And then one of our competitors went and raised money for a third developer on that site. And best of luck to them. I hope they, you know, they do okay. But we saw all kinds of challenges in the site in terms of actually building it, in terms of getting the zoning, in terms of getting the sales price that they want to get. So, you know, we poke a lot of holes and we say no a lot more than we say yes. So
that's good to know. And so as an investor, somebody wants to come to you, what would you provide? Like, how do you, at this stage? I mean, obviously you're not, you're only so far down the development process, right? So what do you provide somebody as far as information to make their decision?
Yeah, we show them we prepare a deck. So an investor presentation that gives them, you know, some details on the pro forma and the market and the area and the developer and zoning and all kinds of stuff. So we present that to them. That's the main offering document. And then depending on the deal. So in this deal, we're going to put everything through a subscription agreement. We're not going to have a formal offering memorandum. So the actual investment document will be the offering memorandum. And so we list all the risks in that document. And then in the subscription agreement, we'll have a term sheet and a summary of the development management agreement terms. So the investors can get a sense of what the deal is with the developer and what controls we have in place and what fees the developer is going to take and all that kind of stuff. And then they have the opportunity to look at the limited partnership agreement as well. I'll tell you, most investors don't look at the limited partnership
agreement. I was just about to tell you that.
There's not much in it for them anyways. Yeah. Most of the we control the GP and, you know, it just shows the decisions that we have to decide on with them. But the development management agreement is really the main document that that we want people to look at, and that's part of the subscription agreement. So
give them trust and confidence in the process that you guys have gone through. And I think reputation and previous experiences, past success stories, all that kind of stuff, that speaks volumes to anything else. Like,
yeah,
if I were
sure.
looking at it, I wouldn't. You could give me the fanciest document in the world, but if you can't show me that, you know, this has been a proven track record over however many years before, and that you've had other successful projects of notable developments and stuff, I would be more skeptical.
And let's be real. I mean, most investors, like, nobody believes the stuff in there completely. They know that it's like hopeful or possible, but it's like they trust you. They trust your board. They trust your experience when they're making decisions like that, because at the end of the day, nobody knows what's going to happen and when, but they trust, you know, the people that they're investing with. It's like anything else, right?
Well, and I think another thing is a lot of people have become developers in the last 5 or 6 years. So, you know, we have a longer track record in the industry than a lot of developers do, that the new developers. And I say new, like there's brands that are big that have 30 projects and have raised tons of money, but they've never finished one. You know,
some of them have bought deals from me.
Yeah. So people are investing with these guys all the time, but they haven't been through a cycle. And I've been around since 11, but my partner is Anthony Heller, and he tells me stories of, you know, one of the stories that I think you guys might like is in the early 90s, we had a big recession and real estate prices dropped by 25%. And one of my favorite stories of Plaza Corp is that they were doing retail plazas, you know, before the 90s. And Woolworth was a tenant, and Woolworth went bankrupt and the plazas were in trouble. But he also was building in 91. He had three condo developments, I think it was like 300 and something units under construction. They were mostly owner occupiers. It wasn't really investors back then, but they didn't have 20% deposits. They maybe had 10% deposits, and they lost 20% value overnight. Three people didn't close.
That's it.
And so that's what made him decide to go into residential. He said, when people are buying a house, they're going to close. And now you have a 20% deposit and you can get sued by the developer if you don't close. People are going to figure out a way to close, even if they've lost value. And that's
like $80,000 condos probably at the time, right?
Yeah, they weren't the same price for sure. But it just shows that there's a lot more resilience in the residential market than in other parts of real estate. And then, you know, to me, the anecdote is more of like, well, he's been through these cycles. He knows what, you know, what to expect and how to navigate. And a lot of developers today have only seen the market going up.
Right. So when you're in an environment like this, and we were talking the other day, like when you're bringing this ordeals, multiple deals to investors, you don't want to take them into harm's way, especially when people are nervous now and not sure about where things are going and where things are heading. So what are you looking for now in deals that make you feel comfortable? Because I mean, you don't have to do any deals at all. You could sit around for a couple of years and wait for the dust to settle. Like what makes you comfortable these days, and what are you looking for?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, we did a lot of work in the high-rise space, and today I'm a little gun-shy in high-rise. And it's kind of for two sides to it. I think that you're seeing the high-rise that are selling, you know, at $1,100 a foot moving. And I just don't know how they're going to have enough profit in the deal to actually build it. So you can sell it at $1,100 a foot, but can you build it and have a profit? And, you know, we see deals at 15, 16, 1700, and they're just take a lot longer to get your pre-sales, if you'll even get them. They're just not moving. The more expensive ones aren't moving as fast. So do you want to have a long sales cycle and hope that you actually get there? So, you know, I think high rise only works in specific locations where people want it so bad that they're willing to pay that 1600 a foot where there will be a profit. Maybe it's 1500 a foot where there will be a profit. But then you look back at, you know, who's buying and if it's an investor and will they be able to get a tenant to cover their cost in 5 years when it's finished? And most of the time it's no. So we're kind of gun shy on high rise unless it's a perfect scenario. Where we really see lots of opportunity is in sort of mid rise, like smaller buildings like this 6-story or stack towns and towns. And there's a lot of reasons for it. The main ones are that the construction costs are way less. Like we have a townhouse project at Vic Park and Shepherd that we just raised some money for, where we're talking about selling the townhouses for $800-$900 a foot. And just down the street, a developer at Shepherd and Vic Park earlier this year sold condos at like $1,200 a foot there. And the condo that you're buying there, you know, might be 600 square feet for $1 million, but our townhouse will be 1,000 square feet for $1 million, so or 1,100. So
and have a backyard.
And well, may not have a balcony.
Oh, it's a stack.
Rooftop, it's a stack. So if you're on the top one, you'll have a rooftop balcony. And I just think it's a way better. We call it attainable housing. It's you know, we're not worried about, is that going to sell? Are we going to be able to sell a 3-bedroom townhouse for $1 million at Vic Park and Shepherd? I'm not worried about that. We're not going to sell for another year and a half, but I'm not worried about selling that. I am worried about condos selling. So I'm not worried about townhouses selling. The construction costs are much less, more simple. And then with interest rates, like to build a 50-story tower is going to take you at least 4 years of construction. So you're paying 8% for 4 years. That's a much higher cost than it used to be. And in a stack town, you're probably 18 to 24 months of construction, and you know your interest is going to be half. So so both hards and softs are cheaper, and your time is quicker, and investors, you know, love shorter time horizons. So so we're really bullish on towns and stacks, and we think there's still a ton of areas in the 416 with the Finch West LRT and Scarborough and South Etobicoke. We think there's lots of great spots where you could build that. And to people who are looking for housing, that's what I think people want. You know, this whole, the whole Greenbelt thing and the sprawl, you know, I do like the Greenbelt, so I'm not gonna, you know, say anything bad about the Greenbelt. But the reason why the developers want to do that is because that's where the demand is. People want a backyard. They had their condo that they bought in 2015 or 2016 or whatever, and it's had enough of a lift that now they've got a little equity base. And they don't want to live. They're building out their family, and they don't want to live in a shoebox in the sky, and they want more space and a backyard. And so they want to move to Pickering or Stouffville or Brooklyn or one of these smaller outside the city where they can get more, in theory, they can get more space. But we're seeing that even the stack towns in the city, you're getting a lot more space, and it's kind of following the demand, and the demand is for price points that make sense.
That makes sense. It sounds like a lot of the direction you're going into is more for the end users, right? Like you got townhouses, small boutique buildings.
Well, that's another
more
thing,
likely higher percentage of end users.
Well, and as in, like, we've been talking about the Manhattanization of Toronto for 12 years already.
Episode one of our show was called that.
Was it one? It was one of them.
Yeah. So that's been a line we've been saying for 12 years, and that you know, we haven't built since the MURBs. The government got rid of the MURBs, I think, in the early 80s. The MURBs were a tax incentive to build multifamily residential, and then rent control came in, and so nobody built purpose-built rentals for years. And I can tell you there were at least 10 or 12 projects where we in you know, between 2011 and 2020, where we looked at it and said, can we make it a rental building? And the reality was that because you could pre-sell and get deposit money, your equity check was 10 to 15% of the capital stack, because you could use 10% of deposits. If you were building that as a purpose-built rental, you needed 25% of equity
or more.
And there was no way to get even close to the same returns. They just weren't apples to apples. So every developer in the city that wasn't a pension fund said, I'm going to build condo because I can make more return on my equity. It's simple math.
But everybody looked at it and said, like, this should be a purpose-built rental building, but like everybody wants to build them. Right. It never makes more sense to do it. And so hold on. Let me ask you a question. The GST thing, like, did that make a big enough difference? Like, we saw in the news that Dream is going to build 5,000 units now. Like, they're the only ones who said anything. I don't know why they had to make a press release about it, but that's a whole other story. But like, do you notice a big enough difference that you're looking at deals going, now it makes sense to do it?
Well, we kind of, I think Benjamin Tal was talking about this for over a year, get rid of the HST on purpose-built rentals. So we've been saying it for a while, hoping that it would come, expecting it to make a big impact. It makes an impact, but not enough of an impact that you can make things work without the CMHC. So that's the issue. Like, still today, if you have to put, even with the HST saving, you have to put 25% equity down, it doesn't really pencil the same way that a condo would. CMHC helps you, you know, get 80-90% financing, so you can put less equity down, and it makes sense. And that's really what I think we need, is to make them equal, put them on equal playing terms, that you can get the same, you know, you can use the same amount of equity to build the condo building and purpose-built rental. You'll see a lot more purpose-built rentals being built.
But does the does the pro forma make sense to hold on to and keep that building, or does the pro forma only make sense to get it to a certain point and sell it to a pension fund?
It depends if the pension funds are paying crazy cap rates. So for a long time in the city, there was such huge demand. And I think a lot of them were buying older apartment stock where they saw lifts as the rent turnover was going to come. I don't think you'll get the same cap rate on a new build. The one we're building, I'd like to keep. We built in a right to purchase it from the LP when it's finished and let the limited partners decide if they want to stay or they want to go. I do think a lot of our investors and Canadian wealthy Canadians in general built their wealth by investing in apartments in the 70s and 80s. And you see a lot of families that still own those apartment buildings because, you know, they're just cash cows. So I do think it makes sense to see if you can hold on. But you got to make, builders are typical in that they want to build something and move on to the next project. They don't really want to stay on and manage something. So it's got to make sense that they'll get an exit at completion, whether it's the investor group that funds the building of it that's going to buy it from them, or they sell it to a pension fund. They've got to show an ability for them to take their profit out, because otherwise they don't want to build it. Mm-hmm. So
the HST being removed is helpful, adding more $20 billion more into the fund to be able to provide more access to capital. What else, like in your circles, what else do you guys talk about? What would be an incentive the government could give that would allow a developer to do more purpose-built rentals?
Well, I think the MURBS is a good kind of playbook to look at. And I, for years, I kept talking about, because I come from the securities world, the mining and oil and gas, and how they do flow throughs and they give all kinds of tax incentives to that industry to go explore and try to find something. Film tax credits. If you come here and film something, you're going to get a ton of money from the government to film it because they want you to come here and do that. The government wants builders to come here and build. Why don't they have a flow through or a tax for building too? If you made it, like one of the things with investing in one of the big differences is if you buy a piece of real estate and you hold it and you sell it, you get capital gains treatment. If you build something, you get income treatment. So in the purpose-built rental, you can build it and hold it for a little while and then get capital gains treatment. But in the condo or build to sell, it's always income. So they could play with the tax treatment a little bit and try to incentivize through tax breaks to build more. And the public might say, what do you need tax breaks for developers? But it's not, the developers are just guys who have the skill set and capability. They always use other people's money and they need to access that money. And so we need to do things to make that money more accessible to them if they want to build more. So I think a tax break for the investors would be a great way to get to stimulate a lot of building. And you could target it. You could say, you know, you got to have a certain amount of affordable in the building, or certain locations are transit oriented. There's all kinds of things that they could do if they wanted to target where they give those tax breaks.
That's a great answer. Yeah. So both on the investor's side as well as the developer side, for their tax break, so it'll spur more investment into real estate.
Sure.
If purpose-built rental is what we want to see, there are ways to make it happen. I mean, people talk about bringing back rent control, and that's the first way to kill it. So, I hope we don't see that.
Oh God!
The best way to control rents is to build a lot more.
Build enough so that people have a couple of options, and then everything just works itself out. It's like, hello, like why? But the problem is now, like if you look over your left shoulder, there's like 300 new people, and you look over your right shoulder, there's another 300 new people that weren't there yesterday. And then 3 days from now, you're going to look over, there's 800 people on both sides. And like, We're all, like, we were, even if we cut back to, like you were saying, 400,000 people a year, we were already behind when we were doing 400 on average. We were only doing 400 on average the last few years. Before that was like even half of that. Do you remember when 400 like doubled the average and everybody was like, holy shit, they're going to bring in 400 a year? Then we were like, then they said 425 and we were like, what are they doing? 425. This
just
is
do
crazy.
400. 400.
And it's like, oh shit, we brought in 2 million by accident. Oops. Like,
yeah.
But we still haven't even felt that. We're like still just like they're coming out of the woodwork. We're still kind of starting to notice that this is like, holy shit, there's a lot of people around. Where are they going to live? And now it's getting cold, right? Like the ones who already have been here for a couple months and couldn't figure out where to live and could only figure out under a bridge or in a park or in a tent or on a sidewalk. Like their options are getting limited every day, right? And we're not building more. Like we're building nothing, right? Nothing new, right now. Right? And I don't know, other than the center court launch in Pickering, like what are any of these other launches doing? Anything selling?
Yeah, I haven't heard.
I haven't heard anything good.
Bunch of launches, but I haven't heard anything that sold as well as the center court one.
Yeah, which means they didn't.
But there's another anecdote that I have is someone was telling me the other day that they're living in an apartment in the middle of the city and they're paying $1,200 a month and it's a family and and they had a big inheritance. And I was like, oh, are you going to go buy something?
No way.
How would I ever get my housing costs down to this? And I'm like, so you're going to live in this apartment forever? Forever. Until they could find some similar housing.
New York.
And so that family is holding on to that rental unit that could go to someone who really needs that $1,200 and they could go pay more for housing somewhere else, but they're not because
their kid's gonna live there next.
The delta between leaving that place for $1,200 and going to a new place is probably $3,500 that they'd have to pay. It doesn't make any sense for them to leave, and they're gonna stay until someone tears that building down. And so if you had a lot more new construction, you would see rents wouldn't need to be as high because there would be a lot more of it. And the people who are in these cheaper rents would be able to move to somewhere and free up that. It's the same with housing. Like if you build a lot more $1 million houses, you'll see, you know, movement and people will move up and then the cheaper stuff will become available to people again. But right now people are holding on to their low cost housing if they have it.
So let's just look at a scenario. So the city's a little looser with permits and you got guys like us and we're coming in and we're bringing them their development applications and most people are kind of gun shy at the moment to launch. So there's a bunch of people just kind of sitting around waiting to see what happens. And then there's all kinds of permits, no labor, a whole bunch of new people looking for houses, but the houses that they want, you can't make any money off of building them. So you just build more of the same crap that no one can really live in comfortably. Like, how does this thing kind of correct itself? And then, like, how long does it really take? And is it like, if they gave us all of the resources that you're asking for right now, we couldn't even build enough if we got all the permits, right? We couldn't build enough. So even if they give us all that stuff, it doesn't even really solve the problem at all, because there's still way like too big a gap between who needs housing and how much there is affordable. Like we see there's inventory now, right? We see there's inventory in new and in resale all over the bloody place. But nobody can afford that shit, or nobody wants to buy it, or interest rates are making it harder to afford. TK, you want to jump in? Go.
It's okay.
I don't have anything
finish.
Else.
Okay. This is such a huge point that everyone always talks about is like, we need more housing. And Devin, you want there to be more housing. Daryl, you want there to be more housing. I totally get it. You guys want to build. But we have also a lot of underutilized housing. The whole baby boomer population, everybody that I go to meet with has got a big 4-bedroom house with just 2 people in their 60s or 70s who are just living the good life and nowhere to go. We have a huge shift in housing needs that are going to change. People are going to require smaller spaces. People are going to, new Canadians will live with more people in one property. The baby boomers will get old. They'll go into smaller spaces that are more suitable to them, and that there is going to be a huge shift that's natural. We were talking about this being a crisis. We were like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen when all those baby boomers need to sell their homes? We're going to have so many vacant four-bedroom detached two-story homes in North York and whatever. And now we're like, oh, now we don't have enough big homes. Oh my gosh, right? Like, it's just the flavor of the week, how people change their tune so fast. So I don't think what you're saying is as accurate, where we're going to be under housed forever. Yes, we can do a spreadsheet that shows that we have not enough houses being built based on a number of new people who are moving in. That's easy to do. But as far as people's lifestyles, how many people per household, underutilization of housing, all that kind of stuff, when you start factoring those things in, I don't think we're going to have the crisis that everybody is talking about. We still need more housing. We still need to build faster than ever. We still need to have as much as possible. But I think that there's going to be a leveling out in the markets eventually, where we start to see over the next 10 years, and we haven't built as much as we think, the 20, 30, 5 million units, but like, it's just nowhere near reality, right? But we're going to start seeing a new lifestyle come up that people will be comfortable living in. And that, you know, that adjustment to,
you know, when they were comfortable living like that last time, it was called the Great Depression, bro. When everybody had to split up their houses 17 ways.
Yeah.
To pay,
and it's
the
called
bills,
New York,
right?
City, and it's called Hong Kong, and it's called all these other places that people have. It's not everywhere in Canada that's like this.
No, it's
right?
Not everywhere.
Very, and so now
Toronto-centric.
We've got places who are like allowing more houses to be built. We've got urban boundaries being expanded. We got garden suites. We've got all these little microcosms of markets that are happening that are allowing for more places for people to live. And I think that there'll just be an adjustment overall. I don't think we will have the lifestyle that we're used to from the 70s, 80s, and 90s ever coming back again, and that people will be living a busier, more congested lifestyle in this country. I think that's just where it's, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
What happens with prices?
They're going to be market dependent.
I think there's a wealth gap, and I think it's just going to continue to expand. Mm-hmm. I say this all the time. If you were a homeowner before 2016, you're doing pretty well. And unless you leverage like crazy, but if you, whatever type of home you had before 2016, you're doing pretty well. And you know, the baby boomers are going to help their children either by
choice or force.
either inheritance, or they, you know, they sell their house for a ton of money when they downsize, and they gift their kids money to be able to get into the market. It's just going to continue. The wealth gap is this whole thing. Like even you guys were just saying before, you know, an individual buying a condo for rent is now not good, but we should be building purpose-built rentals. Well, who's going to put the money up? It's going to be big institutional investors and family offices and wealthy, wealthy, wealthy people. And they're just going to get wealthier because rents are going up, and they're going to make money. And you know, one of the things with rising interest rates, you can't afford your house anymore, but you need a place to live. So, you know, I've heard the story of the sale and leaseback, where you sell it to someone who's wealthy and can't afford the interest rates, and they lease it back to you because you need a place to live and you're willing to pay a rent now. And maybe it doesn't happen in that specific house, but you sell your house and you rent somewhere else. But that's just going to continue with the way interest rates are. Someone was telling me about the cottage country and how right now, if you want to buy a cottage under $3 million, they're getting killed. Like, you know, $1 million, $1.5 million, $2 million cottages are easy to pick up. They're hard to sell. There are tons available, but there's a $13, $11, and $8 million cottage transactions that are not held back. They're happening. And it's because those guys don't pay interest. Mm-hmm. Interest rates don't affect a $10 million guy. So that wealth gap is just going to continue to grow. And you talk about New York City and Hong Kong and Paris and London, and the wealthy are uber wealthy, and the middle class really
disappeared.
Can't get there.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's totally disappeared. They just can't get to the same, they can't get past the middle class.
Well, we should call them poor now, but they won't allow it. Right.
Well, there's poor below them.
They've always
well,
been
they,
saying that.
We
though.
Need
every,
a new
every
name
generation
for them.
Says that they said if I had only bought plazas and apartment buildings back in the 70s, it's the only way I could ever have, like, you know, a 10-digit net worth, you know? And back in the 70s, I said, well, if I'd only bought an after the Great Depression, if I'd only immigrated to Canada on that ship back in 1810, it's always like that. The rich is always going to be getting, the longer you've been invested in the markets, the longer you started, the more wealth you're going to create. So I don't feel this is a bad thing. I don't think there's anything broken here. I think that, yes, there's people who will get wealthier because of the position that they're in and the time that they started. And there'll be a new generation of people in the middle class who have an opportunity to start their generational wealth, and they'll find a way to do it, and their kids will benefit from it, right?
They can do it on this deal here in Forest Hill with Mr. Cranston.
How can I sign up?
But the media focuses on the younger generation, the millennials, not able to buy and all this stuff. Yeah. But the politicians know that the people who vote are homeowners who have had their houses before 2015, and they don't want to see housing drop. So there's a lot more people, I think, in at least that vote, that have a vested interest in the housing market, you know, not dropping, versus the media and the people that they're, you know, the sensational stories sell. And so they don't want to talk about the cushy, you know, the homeowners who are comfortable because their values have gone up so much, and how they have to basically help the next generation. They want to talk about the pain that's in the market.
The money goes somewhere. The money always goes. It's not like the money doesn't go anywhere. These people aren't just storing their money somewhere and not investing it. They're investing in projects with you guys.
But it's the wealth gap.
I think there's a ton of people who just got rid of their mortgages.
Yeah, that too.
Yep.
They may not have invested. They might not have got the HELOC. They might be sitting on a $4 million home in the middle of the city with no mortgage.
Yeah.
I mean, my parents are an example. They had to go through a few different housing options in the last couple of years to get to, they bought in pre-construction. It's an interesting story. They had a condo in Liberty Village, and they wanted to move to Avenue Sinclair where they would like to retire. And they bought an Avenue Sinclair in pre-construction while they were living in Liberty Village. And through the life of the build, when they went to sell in Liberty Village, it was more money than what they paid for Avenue Sinclair, same size unit. So they were able to get into Avenue Sinclair with no mortgage. And so it's great for retirement. And I think that's, you know, Do they have money? They're not wealthy. They don't have a ton of money, but now they're comfortable because they don't have to pay a mortgage. They don't have to deal with the interest rates, and their wealth is all in that condo that they have. And I think you're going to see a lot of that.
Yeah, that's how my parents are too. My parents sold their house, moved into a nice condo. It's got no debt on it, at least not now. But that's probably what a lot of people have. Mm. But they're not selling, they're staying, and, you know, they're on fixed incomes. And so, you know, they almost don't count. I don't mean to say that in a rude way, but like they're kind of over there. They're not causing any trouble. They're not really part of things, but it's the other people. Fine, voting, which like that makes a difference these days. But they do vote, that's true. But it's the people that did take all the money out of their house since they bought it back then and lived a life that could not continue unless the perpetual upward motion continued forever and ever. I mean, look around. Like, there's a lot of people that live lifestyles that are way beyond what their paycheck should allow, right?
I still think that's a small portion of the population. And I think it is a millennial thing too. A lot of them love to live life, which nothing against that. And they spend more than they can. And they, you know, had a good thing going for a little while. But I do think that the majority of people, at least in Toronto, are homeowners, and they've had their homes for a while. And they, like your parents, are just sitting there. And, you know, they eventually there will be a transaction when they no longer need that housing to move to a senior's home or something, but they're just gonna sit and you know, be fine.
So TK, once again, did not figure out the housing crisis.
We had some great articles to discuss, but like Dems is too interesting to talk to. So we'll get those next show, Daryl.
Well, TK, one thing that I'd like to maybe bring up to you, and one thing I've seen a lot in the market, people talk about the pre-construction and where the buyers are, but at least in my world, a lot of the people who were buying in the last 2 or 3 years were using house money. They bought a pre-construction in 2011. It finished in 2015. They made so much money. They bought another pre-construction. It finished in 2019. They made so much money. They bought another pre-construction. So they're not as hit as hard as like a millennial is trying to live there, right? The investors who have been investing in this condo market for 7 or 8 years, as much as like the ones they've done in the last 2 years might not do very well, I still think they're ahead of the game. I don't know if you see that too.
100%. The issue is the people who bought recently because of this craziness, I'm running into people who bought 3, 4, 5, 6 pre-constructions. And they are like
they're holding that amount of paper
as much
now.
Equity and wealth that was built from this market, we're going to watch evaporate because of some of the poor decisions that some people made, you know? And that's true. And they're all the same type of stories. It was all FOMO. It was all like, oh, I'm going to get rich quick. And it's just, there's no book ever written on how to get rich quick that's ever been a bestseller that, you know, held the test of time. You know what I mean?
Or they always, the
at the end, someone loses
money
and they say that book was garbage, right? So it's just the way it goes. Yeah. So I'm not sure what else we could talk about today because we're at the end of our show. But Devin, I just want to maybe, how would people reach out to you if they want to get more information about Daryl's deal? We're going to have a link, but anything more to say about that?
Yeah. So Daryl's deal, we're actually going to launch next week. We're going to host a webinar middle of October. So the details of that will come out. If you click the link that you guys put out, we'll get your info and we'll put you on our list to get you invited to that webinar. And the one thing I'll say is that it's not a lot of money that we're raising, and I think it's going to go really quickly. So as much as investors need to do their due diligence, there's not going to be a lot of time to make decisions. They're going to have to, you know, figure out they want to be in this deal and get in it quickly.
You should have seen TK. I went to their office a couple of days ago and I was sitting around the boardroom with all of them and their sales team. And they were like fighting and punching each other and they were fighting over allocations for this deal. And I was like, holy cow. I didn't realize how great this deal was, but you should have seen one guy body slammed a girl on the desk. It was crazy.
Yeah, so it's only
very 5 million.
HR department is just going wild right now.
I said to Daryl, like, it's $5 million. I said, we could probably raise 15. Obviously, we're not going to, the more equity you put into a deal, the worse the returns are for people. Yeah. So we want to limit how much equity goes in. But if we could find sites like this that pencil so well, we would, you know, do 2 or 3 more of these, no problem. We do have a fund. So the Krantz Capital Real Estate Development Fund, it's for RSP, TFSA, or just general investing. It's small tickets. So you can come in for as little as 25K or as much as our biggest investor and is a couple $1 million. And that fund is invested already in 3 projects. The townhouse one I mentioned at Vic Park and Shepherd is one of them. And they're in 2 other, one in Pickering and one in Stouffville. And the fund will go into Daryl's deal as well. And then the fund will continue as we raise more capital to invest in more and more development projects. So I always say RSPs and TFSAs are great for this because they're long-term in nature and the tax treatment, obviously, in RSP and TFSAs is pretty good. So, you know, if you're using your RSP in day trading, it's not, you know, your RSP is a long-term thing and development is long-term. So they match up nicely. And our fund is a great way for investors to do that. Investing directly in Daryl's deal is a limited partnership, which has other benefits. We sell both. You can invest in the fund or directly in the limited partnership.
Awesome. Amazing. We appreciate you coming on the show today.
Yeah,
this has been great.
Thank you so much.
You know a lot of stuff. Thanks. And I know people really enjoyed listening to it or watching it on YouTube. If they're still listening and they haven't liked, commented, and subscribed to our channel,
that would be a good time.
I think this is a fantastic time to do that. Yeah. And check out the link below for the webinar and get more information on the deal of a lifetime.
The deal of a lifetime. And you know what? It's great. Like having guys like Devin around. Like he's not just like, I don't know, for those of you that have financed deals or worked in some of these major kind of deals, like he's a really nice guy and he's actually not just acting like that on camera. And it's nice because some of these guys that you got to deal with, they're not as nice.
Right? A private equity guy that I dealt with 10 years ago once called me the nicest guy on Bay Street. And I didn't know if it was a compliment or an insult.
No, you know what? Like, probably from his perspective, you know, you probably aren't, you know, seem like soft because they want all these crazy, like macho, crazy, like you see in the movies. But like, from my perspective, it's much more comforting to have somebody that you don't feel will put a knife in your back the minute he has a chance, because they're out there everywhere. It's like, this is a big pond we play in, right?
Yeah, where I've also had someone call me a hard ass. And I think part of that is my background is I'm a CMA and I'm a numbers guy, and you're not going to sneak things by me, and I'm going to ask the hard questions. And, you know, there's always a way to find a solution to a problem, but you know, no one's going to kind of pull the wool over our eyes here. So we know what we're doing, we're experienced, and we're detail oriented. So yeah. We're going to check all the dot all the I's and cross all the T's and look out for our investors' best interest.
It's great.
Awesome.
Very happy to be surrounded by such wonderful professional people. And then, I mean, nobody's listening anymore, but we're seriously happy to announce that we have like the best architect in Forest Hill on the team too. So if you thought it was interesting before, and if you're on the list already from the last time we talked about it, you don't need to sign up, but if you are interested, there will be a link down below. Put in your email next week when everything is ready. You will get a package from Devin and Co. And we are way over. It was an exciting episode. It was an informative episode. And once again, TK, I feel like we learned nothing. And that's how we like it around here, right? Because we don't know everything. We're just shooting the shit.
Yeah.
Thanks, Devin.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.